From the big screen to the small screen now, when the television show I Love Lucy debuted in 1951, mainstream America knew very little about Latino culture, but the character of Ricky Ricardo changed all that. His heavily accented English and rapid-fire Spanish were as new to some parts of the country as television itself. And then there was the music. In this installment of National Public Radio's In Character series, NPR's Felix Contreras offers this musical portrait of Ricky Ricardo, a fictional character who played very real music.
I'm sitting in NPR Studio 4A with the Paracongas. I've been playing for over 35 years, and I can't tell you the number of times people have not been able to resist coming up to these drums and doing this and singing this. Ricky Ricardo's version of Babalu was a mix of fact and fiction, like everything else about him. The television character Ricky Ricardo was based on a very real Cuban bandleader and vocalist named Desiderio Arnaz Idiacha, or Desi Arnaz. Ricky was from Havana, Desi was from Santiago de Cuba. Ricky migrated to New York, Desi to Miami. Ricky married Lucy McGillicuddy, Desi married Lucille Ball. Ricky's wife desperately wanted to be in show business. Desi's wife was already a successful radio and film actress. Ricky eventually owned a nightclub. Desi eventually owned television and movie studios. So with just a few changes, the I Love Lucy writers turned Desi into Ricky.
They retained much of his character and his emotional side.
That's 81-year-old trumpeter Tony Terran, the last surviving member of the Ricky Ricardo Orchestra. He says while Ricky may have been fictional, his band was very real, and it was Terran's introduction to Hollywood.
When I first came into the business, 19 years old, when I was doing the Bob Hope Show with Desi.
The Ricky Ricardo Orchestra was made up mostly of the Desi Arnaz Orchestra, which had been playing in ballrooms and theaters around the country when not performing on Hope's radio show. Yet many in Hollywood had their doubts about a television show based on an all-American girl married to a Latino. The musicians felt differently.
I think the general feeling in the band was that it was quite a venture. It made some sense to us. You know, we didn't have the same doubts CBS had.
Terran says many popular orchestras back then, both Anglo and Latin, were designed for mass appeal, alternating between swing and Latin rhythms, with vocalists singing in both English and in Spanish. Desi Arnaz got his start in the late 1930s with a band led by an early Latin crossover success, Xavier Cugat. Arnaz wrote in his autobiography that he patterned his own band after Cugat, and Tony Terran says the Ricky Ricardo Orchestra played the same kind of music.
We were commercial. We were more for TV.
They call me Cuban Pete. I'm the king of the rumba beat. When I play the maracas, I go chick chicky boom, chick chicky boom.
It was corny but commercial. You know, I mean, it wasn't the hip Latin music.
Percussionist John Rodriguez remembers both kinds of orchestras. His father played in Latin bands and so-called society bands in New York in the late 1940s. The younger Rodriguez got his start at age 17 with Tito Puente in 1962. He says he heard from his dad and older musicians in Puente's band that there were plenty of rewards for orchestras like Ricky Ricardo's.
Those are like high-paying gigs. They weren't the standard Latin gig. It was an upper-end, better-paying job, you know? This is Broadway, this is Paramount Theater, Roxy Theater. This is not the Palladium, it's not a Latin club, you know? So you're talking about playing to Americanos, so mostly Americans, you know?
Millions of Americanos tuned into I Love Lucy, and most of them probably didn't realize Ricky Ricardo's signature song was a tribute to an Afro-Cuban god. Babalu, written by Cuban composer Margarita Lecuona, is about Babalu Aye, one of the seven main gods of the Afro-Cuban religion Santeria. It was first recorded by Cuban vocalist Miguelito Valdez in 1941, and among fans of more traditional Latin music, he was the real Mr. Babalu.
Babalu,
Latin music fans will also say Ricky Ricardo was probably not the most authentic Afro-Cuban percussionist, but John Rodriguez says that was okay.
I remember my dad saying that he was a terrible conga player. You see him playing on TV, it makes it look like it's great. The way they staged it, it looked good on TV. And that's all that mattered.
It mattered because television and Ricky Ricardo helped spread the word about Latin music across the country even more than radio.
TV had this show and had this Latin music on a regular basis every week. They were the number one show for 6 consecutive years.
That's Fordham University sociology professor Clara Rodriguez. She points out that folks in the U.S. got their first taste of Latin music from films of the 1940s that featured Carmen Miranda and Desi Arnaz's old boss, Xavier Cugat. But while they were exotic, television's Ricky Ricardo had much more in common with Middle America.
He played a Latino who had a job, a steady job. They lived a middle-class way of life. He was the man for those times who was the breadwinner in the family. So he introduced a character which wouldn't have been very different if he had not been ethnic.
Ricky Ricardo was easy for non-Latins to accept. But I've often wondered whether or not this Latino everyman would have been as successful a band leader as his real-life counterpart, Desi Arnaz, was in the television business. Tony Tarrin, who worked with both, says yes.
If Lucy wouldn't get him in trouble all the time.
Your Highness, I understand that your favorite number of ours is Babalu.
Ah! Babalu!
Felix Contreras, NPR News.
There's music from the last surviving member of the Ricky Ricardo Orchestra and more at our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Gustav Mahler died 97 years ago today, May 18, 1911. Known as a great composer, he was also one of the finest conductors of his time and one of the greatest opera conductors of all time. He worked himself up from provincial summer opera theaters in Bohemia to become conductor of 2 of the top opera companies on the planet, the Vienna Court Opera and the Metropolitan Opera in New York City. You could also say that Mahler was the best opera composer never to have actually written a single opera. Here to discuss what may or may not be a paradox about Mahler almost a century after his death is Weekend Edition's classical music commentator Robert Greenberg. Nice to talk to you again.
Great to be back.
Okay, that paradox, a great opera composer who never composed a single opera, what's up? Why not?
I think for Mahler, his symphonies were his operas, his all-inclusive artworks. Mahler, as you mentioned, was a great conductor of opera. He was also a great composer for the voice. He composed over 50 songs for the voice, many of them, most of them, originally for piano and voice, but then he orchestrated many of these. And then, of course, he wrote 9 numbered symphonies, began a 10th symphony, and then a wonderful piece for orchestra and voices called Das Lied von der Erde, The Song of the Earth. You know, if we had him sitting here with us right now, and if he would deign to talk to us, because he was a thorny character and he might simply walk out and discuss, but if we said, Gustav, buddy, why didn't you write any operas? And do you plan any? He'd say, of course I'm not going to write any operas. I don't need to write any operas. My symphonies are my operas. My symphonies tell these wonderful stories. Many of my symphonies use voices. Many other of my symphonies employ melodies originally composed for my songs. And so whatever emotional or spiritual representation that song melody had originally now is planted into the symphony. So my symphonies are my all-inclusive art forms, and they have the same dramatic punch as anybody's opera.
Let me ask you about this. 9 completed and numbered symphonies, although the Song of the Earth that you mentioned, it wasn't numbered as a symphony. I mean, because this thorny character, Mahler, he had, what, a fear of the ninth? What is that?
Yeah, a healthy fear of the ninth, okay. I would add. Everyone looks at Beethoven's 9 symphonies as the canon of modern symphonies, and it's true. Beethoven started a 10th and died. Dvorak, 9 symphonies, dies. Bruckner, 9 symphonies, dies. You know, I come around there and I start thinking there's something bad about trying to go past the number 9. So what Mahler did, he wrote 8 numbered symphonies. Then he wrote this piece that was called initially Symphony No. 9, Das Lied von der Erde, a Song of the Earth. Decided not to call it the Ninth Symphony and not bring the curse down upon his head. So he called it Das Lied von der Erde instead. Then he composed his 9th Symphony and he thought he had cheated God. He started his 10th and died. So, you know, you just don't tempt certain things, and Mahler did.
Brought a song, and I'm not going to try the German, but it's Songs of a Wayfarer. And this was something, what, he put it into his first symphony? Tell us what Mahler was doing here.
It is the first song of the Songs of a Wayfarer, which tell the sad story of a young man whose love has been rejected, and slowly he goes from denial and an attempt to find joy in his world to abject depression by the last song. But this is the first song, and he's still trying to find solace in beauty and in nature. And the name of the song is Ging heut Morgen übers Feld. In the morning I went over the field. And there's a beautiful pastoral melody that Mahler created up for these words, which, by the way, were of his own creation as well.
Ging heut Morgen übers Feld, auch auf den Gräsern hin, sprach zu mir der lustige Ding, ein Geld. Guten Morgen, ein Geld, du bist nicht eine schöne Welt, schöne Welt.
When he turned to writing his first symphony a few years later, he decided simply to take that melody that had represented this nature scene in the first song and make it the first theme of the first movement of his first symphony. In Mahler's own ear, the same moods of natural beauty tinged by the bitter pain of rejection existed in the first symphony as well.
Gustav Mahler was a rather young 50 when he died from a bacterial infection. You talked about him starting his 10th symphony, but do you think if he had lived longer, he would have composed an opera?
I don't think so. I don't think he felt the compelling need to write an opera. He made this very famous statement at one point: the symphony is the world, it must contain everything. But having said that, it contains opera as well as the symphony for him. So no, I feel his symphonies really were his all-inclusive artworks.
His dying word?
His dying word was Mozart. And he becomes one of any number of composers. Chopin's dying words were, "Play Mozart for me." I think they were both glimpsing heaven at that moment. Paradise.
Music historian Robert Greenberg. He's with San Francisco Performances in the Teaching Company, which markets recorded lectures in the arts and sciences, and he joined us from member station KQED in San Francisco. Robert, thanks again.
My great pleasure.
Gustav Mahler was buried in a suburb of Vienna after his death on May 18, 1911. The ceremony was simple, even austere. You can hear music from Mahler's symphonies and song cycles and explore classical concerts and studio performances all at our website, npr.org/music. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.
In this age of press releases and emails, not to mention iPods and iTunes, it's amazing how many compact discs promoting artists new and old still find their way into our mailboxes. Sometimes these arrivals include a true gem. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg got such a musical delivery the other day.
It's a CD called Language. The singer is Lorraine Feather.
They're not up on the dresser. I've looked and they're not underneath the bed or in the laundry. Pardon me while I go out of my head.
The poor thing is obviously pretty upset about something.
They're not in any pocket. Thank God I didn't lock them in the car, but I'm so late now. And I'd appreciate your help if you might have any clue to where they are. Where are my keys?
Oh, that's it. Sound familiar? Lorraine Feather has lost her keys.
Where are my keys? I'd give anything if I could find mine.
Lorraine Feather sings about life's ordinary aggravations, losing keys, losing focus, losing grip. She joins us from KUOW in Seattle. Hi, Lorraine.
Hi, Susan.
Now, this is a song that every single one of us could sing, Where Are My Keys? But we do it if only we had your voice. Everybody's had this experience, but what led you to write a song about it? And by the way, all these lyrics are yours.
I wrote this song because I am very absent-minded. It was written, by the way, with Tony Morales, who's my husband, and Terry Sampson. And more than almost anything I've written over the years, people have said, it's the funniest thing because my fill-in-the-blank wife, husband, girlfriend is always losing his keys. But often when I'm working on a song, I think of one line that amuses me or a title, and I just decide to take it from there. Tony had put together this track, and I started singing Where Are My Keys over the chorus part, and it just kind of tickled me, so I made it into a song.
You also write about another kind of low-level panic.
I was stuck in a rut,
and I was explaining to you how I had this fear that in 30 years I'd be frail, destitute, and alone. Nothing to show for my life, nothing. Living in a house of cats, afraid to go to the store, not so attractive anymore. I was going on about it at great length. All of a sudden I stopped and sighed, and you replied, I can hear every word you say, but it's very unbecoming. Now and again you may feel that way, but it's very unbecoming.
This poor thing, she is a wreck, and that's his response?
That was inspired by somebody who was complaining to us many years ago, saying, oh, this person really screwed me over, and then this happened, and it always seems to happen to me, and it was so unfair. And after he walked away, we looked at each other. I said, gee, it's all too bad. And Tony said, yes, but it's very unbecoming, isn't it?
but you know,
and I've said things unbecoming as well, of course.
There's so much to worry about. It can take up absolutely all your time. The cruel tricks of...
You have such pretty harmony.
The decline of music, the way the world is run.
The harmonies are me with Janice Siegel and Cheryl Benteen of the Manhattan Transfer. We sang together on the Dick Tracy soundtrack, and I asked them to participate in the album on a couple of tracks, and it was really fun. We just screamed with laughter.
Well, I think it makes the song even funnier because it's so frantic to to have these pretty chords, you know, sort of the juxtaposition of the two. In Other Annoyances, Lorraine Feather, you write about the telephone call that never gets answered by a live human being.
She said, thanks for calling. This is a recording, but don't be nervous. Our goal is to provide you with excellent service. Please forgive us. No one would intentionally overstrain you. Some music from the 80s will entertain you. We appreciate your patience, and we promise you a customer care representative will be with you shortly. We appreciate...
You're singing about life on eternal hold, right? And that annoying computer voice with this fake concern and the fake manners.
And now they've humanized the voice so that if you say something it doesn't understand, it'll go, oh, no, I'm sorry I didn't get that. Could you please run that by me again? So it's even scarier.
Right. Tell us about you, Lorraine Feather. Where'd you get that great sense of humor, for starters?
Oh, I don't know exactly, but my parents both had a whimsical sense of humor, dry. My father, who was the jazz critic Leonard Feather, would make fun sometimes if I said... I think I'll go down to the drugstore. He would go, when will you know? That kind of thing, to torment me through my whole childhood. And my mom had a dry, strange, quirky little sense of humor, too. So I picked up a lot of it from them, I guess.
Well, your dad, I mean, he was a legend in his day, a writer of jazz and a writer about jazz and a producer, a composer. So was it inevitable that you would be a musician?
In a way, looking back, maybe it was inevitable. I tried to be an actress, and I spent a tremendous amount of time waitressing in New York, and then fell into singing with top 40 and jazz bands just because I always had a good ear. And it was a way to make a few bucks to pay for groceries other than waitressing, which I really was terrible at. Then eventually I started writing lyrics for fun, and it just struck me like a thunderbolt. I loved doing it so much. So it just took over my life.
I came here hoping to be a Broadway star. Another dimple and dewy ingenue who wound up waiting tables when all humanity backs up at the bar. Some nights there's nothing I wouldn't rather do than be here waiting tables.
I am willing to bet that nobody has ever written a song about waiting on tables. You are going to be the hero of every actor wannabe in America.
I would love that. I was so bad at waiting tables, and there are a lot of people who are good at more than one thing. Like, I always remember that Bette Midler said she's great at keeping house. She can make a very tight bed that you can bounce a dime on. And there have been people who went on to other things who were fantastic at waiting tables, but I was not good at it. It was a very interesting time, though. I learned a lot.
Like?
Well, I learned that people can be very rude and condescending. And I learned that it's probably good to stay away from the bar fruit because it's been there for longer than it should be. And also, I'm a good tipper. I wouldn't tip somebody 10% unless they actually spit in my face.
Do people come up to you all the time and say, listen, this awful thing just happened. Why don't you write a song about it?
Yeah, or I'll say something like, I got this eco-friendly nail polish and it doesn't have any formaldehyde and it's water-based, but it's just coming off my nails in sheets. They go, oh, you could write a song about that.
So in this CD, now you have covered losing your keys, sitting on phone hold, waiting tables, traffic, weather. So what is on your list of other life experiences that are minor but just could become major at any moment, and those to put on your next CD?
Oh, well, I was thinking, this isn't really an annoyance, but I was thinking that I might like to write a song about my reluctance to give up drinking coffee because people are always saying it's bad for you, but I really like having that jolt in the morning.
So would the annoyance be when they ran out of coffee?
No.
We got traffic and weather, traffic and weather.
She'll think of something, maybe when she's stuck in traffic.
They're always together.
Thank you very much. Lorraine Feather's new album is called Language. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News, Washington.
Your way, brackish clouds moving inland. Soon you'll think you're in Finland. Still recover from the outages in Walnut Creek. We might have told you different, but it'll rain all week.
And you can hear full songs from Lorraine Feather's new album at our music website, npr.org/music. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.